This is Car Expert.
The Sorento plug-in hybrid, we all fell off our chairs when we heard the price, but once you actually priced a Kluger, it was the same price, if not more.
The one thing that really stuck out to me when I drove the Aston is that it didn't feel like anything or look like anything else that I had ever driven.
Jaguar used to rely on their style and their luxury. To some extent, they've lost all that.
G'day, my name's Mandy Turner. Hello, Tony Crawford.
Hello, Mandy. How are you? Lovely Great. To see you in red. I know the viewers can't see us, but
the yes. listeners even for a podcast.
Exactly. Well, that too. Hello, Paul Marrick.
Some podcasts are videos, Paul.
Hello, Mandy. It's Tony's older age. When we log into this chat, there's a little thing that says health check. And then Tony's, I always worry it's not going to pass. But today he's in good shape.
All those gym visits are paying off, Crawford.
It's all those canyon walks in LA, Mandy, which we'll talk about in a sec.
Well, yes, let's talk about that. You guys have been off to the US with Elbors as well. What were you up to there?
Well, Paul was on a Bentley ticket. Driving the Flying Spur Hybrid, which would have been very nice. Paul will talk about that in a minute. And then we got a couple of other cool cars. Once Paul was finished, we all hooked up, stayed at a fairly ordinary hotel, mind you, not wanting to spend much of the company's money. And it was quite a distance from anywhere in LA, if I can say that. The place is called Montebello. Avoid it like the plague.
Oh, God. What cars were you driving around this place?
Mandy, can I actually just quickly interject by saying when we arrived at the hotel, we thought, oh, this won't be too bad. One of the guests is driving a BMW i8. We then discovered that it had been in quite a serious car accident and it was dumped at the hotel, probably stolen.
Mandy, they were sleeping in it at one stage. Yeah, someone thought it'd make a great place to sleep. Until they actually got in and saw how small it was inside.
Oh, geez. My God. What were you driving? What were you doing there, Croft? Did you have a...
One of our US colleagues, Michael Harley, who's very well known for writing the book on the Singer Reimagined Porsche, and Michael had very kindly acquired a 392 Rubicon Jeep, which has a 6.4-litre Hemi up front. And this is the most fun you could ever have in a Jeep Wrangler. And not since the 80s have Jeep made a V8. And this is, they put the whole lot and the kitchen sink in this thing. And the noise of this thing is absolutely deafening.
I got to say, the noise was remarkable.
Really?
Yeah, the noise was awesome. And the thing that I loved most about it, because it was on these chunky mud terrain tyres, if you stand on the throttle from a standing start, because it has so much power and so little traction, the thing just erupts into wheel spin. It is comical.
we enjoyed it. We loved it. It's very quick. It'll do 0 to 100 in 4.5 seconds. Wow. Which is incredibly quick and completely unassuming from a Jeep Wrangler on 33-inch off-road tyres, as Paul said. And pretty much the standard kit inside, all leather but embroidered 392 on it, and all sorts of sort of bronze gold features all through it. The badging and the tow hooks are all bronze gold, just to separate it from the stock unlimited Jeep Rubicons. But we loved it. It was a fairly thirsty drinker of fuel. I lost count of how many dollars I put into that thing, but
it was
probably about $500 worth of fuel over about 1,200 miles. So I did a lot of driving in that vehicle up and down the freeways. And just to point out that I was listening to the guys talk about the autonomous driving last week on our last podcast with Tesla. And one of the things that really the speeds that US drivers drive at, it wouldn't sit well with the authorities in Australia, let's put it that way, because the average speed was about 85, which amounts to roughly around 140 k's an hour. But many, many people were passing us as though we were standing still at that speed. And I figured they were doing about 120, which would probably be about 180, 190 k's an hour. And with clearly complete immunity, because we rarely saw a police car or police SUV. I think we saw two in the entire week, and we saw one red light camera. So there are clearly no cameras in LA, very few of them, and people seem to drive without the worry of being booked.
How was the Flying Spur, Paul?
Yeah, it was lovely. So we basically set off from Beverly Hills to drive toward Ventura through some of the canyon roads, and it's actually really impressive from the sense that it's the first vehicle that I'm aware on the market that actually uses topography and GPS data to properly utilize the plug-in hybrid feature, because in a lot of plug-in hybrids, they're kind of redundant if you're doing a longer trip, because you exhaust the battery and then, you know, you're running on an internal combustion engine carrying the extra weight of a, you know, battery pack and electric motor, even though you're not using it. So what it does is when you set the destination, regardless of how far away it is from you, it's able to calculate based on the terrain that you're going to drive on when it should be using the electric motor to switch the internal combustion engine off, and when it should be charging the battery on downhill stretches. So its aim is to have you arrive at your destination with the battery empty, but having used it at the most optimal times. So it means that when you do arrive at your destination, you can plug in and charge the vehicle for your return trip. So I think it's pretty cool stuff. And Bentley was saying something like 80% of their customers already own an EV, whether it's a plug-in hybrid or a full electric vehicle, and not necessarily a Bentley one, and that most of them have charging infrastructure at home, because a Bentley customer isn't like a uni student who lives, you know, in an apartment building with 500 other people. They generally have this giant house that they can install charging infrastructure in. So I think that they've really thought it through, and I think this is probably one of the better implementations of a plug-in hybrid system that we've seen. So it uses a turbocharged V6 instead of the V8 in the Porsche range, and it maintains that sort of silky smooth, quiet driving experience.
I suppose we're sort of getting a little bit off topic, but I sort of already know the answer to this anyway, but how do you compare the likes of EV uptake and EV infrastructure between the US and here in Australia?
It's absolutely comical how far behind we are, because I joked with the guys every time we'd see a Tesla, I'd say, oh, look, it's a Tesla. I haven't seen one of those, because literally every car was a Tesla. It was insane. Yeah. It was mostly a Model Y or a Model 3. There's heaps of charging infrastructure as well. So Tony needed some new spectacles. So we went to an outlets sort of center, and there was a whole stack of charging there. You see it on random posts on the side of the road as well. The other vehicle that we were driving was an F-150 Platinum Hybrid. And that is also a really good implementation of just a closed circuit hybrid system. And because of the incentives in California to actually get EVs, a lot of these people are basically buying them for the sake of, you know, being green, I guess you could say.
F-150, tell me more about this. I can't imagine an F-150 with a hybrid in it.
Look, this thing is just crazy. It actually utilizes the 3.5-litre EcoBoost V6 that's used in the Raptor, and then it pairs to a hybrid system. So it has an integrated starter generator to give you that seamless restart experience. It is incredibly smooth and quite powerful as well. But the F-150 is just remarkable. When I had these guys in the car with me, they'd sit in the back, and you could almost fit another row between them and the front seat. There was so much massive room. And this thing has fantastic, just some amazing features. You can actually set the car up to act as a scale. So you know the exact weight of everything going in the tray, and it lights up the tail lights to tell you when you're getting close to your payload limit. It's got this workbench. You press a button and the gear stick disappears into the console, and you fold out a workbench. It has a seat that will fold entirely flat, so you can actually sleep in the car as well. I think people here don't understand how far behind the times we are with dual cab utes. In the States, these are now literally luxury vehicles.
Oh, that was a tremendous amount of luxury in that vehicle.
Yeah.
Not only that, it actually looked luxurious, because it had a really nice navy blue
chrome
with a
sort of
platinum-y chrome panels on it. It really did look like a luxury vehicle. And then, of course, getting in and having that enormous foot room, not only foot room, but elbow room. Like you could have put four people in the back row, not three.
I mean, we could have adequate distance between us and a nasally elbows. It was fantastic.
Yeah, and the other thing that really irks me with Aussie Utes is the complete lack of carrying capacity in those standard trays. I mean, they're absolutely ridiculous. You can't even fit a normal surfboard in them. Yeah. And I always ask myself, why would you buy one of these things? You'd fit more stuff in an SUV than a ute. So I'm you know, but the tray on this thing. So not only is there an enormous first and second row with literally limo size leg room, but you've also got this massive tray that can actually fit probably two pallets in length. And that's what I, as Paul says, you know, that's a real ute that you can actually live and work in it and play and, you know, all that sort of thing. Whereas I find the standard size utes that we have here just inconsequential as far as...
Just be careful of shopping centres. We went into a Westfield and yeah, I think pretty... we must have been 5 millimetres away from collecting every single sprinkler they had in the place, and it was too late to reverse out. So
I have to say, Mandy, Paul's not much chop on a track, but he's pretty good at negotiating US car parks in what is a big vehicle.
Do you find that most Americans, do they actually use those things for work, or is it just
absolutely?
Oh,
yeah.
They do.
No one uses it for work. It's just like here where they drive them around because they want to be bigger than everyone else.
I thought so.
It's like Tony with his, with his Mustang. It's got all the fancy bits on it, but it's never once seen a racetrack. You wouldn't know what to do with it.
It has seen the old pack highway, Paul, many times.
At a very lowly pace.
I'll have to take you on with that Tesla. Pretty sure I could beat you.
I'd be happy to stop for you to catch up every now and then.
How is your Tesla going, by the way, Paul?
Good. I'm actually selling it at the moment. Yes, so I'm buying something
too quick
else.
For him, Mandy.
So tell me another Holden.
No. I'm buying something. I'll tell you what I'm buying later on, but now's the perfect time to sell it because there's a giant wait list for the new Model 3 or a new Model 3. So I thought, may as well list mine. Someone will snap it up at a ridiculous price.
Isn't it very few of your performance editions?
Yeah, there's only something like 6 or 7 listed on car sales, and I'm the only one in Victoria. So it's crazy that we ran the story the other day about the sales numbers here in Australia, and they had sold over 12,000 last year. And it's really interesting that there's so few listed for sale. And I think it really comes – the only reason we're selling it is because we need a bigger vehicle with our daughter. Otherwise, I'd keep it because every month, every 2 weeks, you get a new software update with extra features. So it's not like buying any other car on the market where you buy it and you got to wait till the new one comes out to get something. We literally just keep getting new features and you have no reason to sell it.
Mandy, you can guess what he's buying, surely.
Not that far away
from what he's already got, Mandy. Just step up a little bit.
Oh, another EV?
Yeah, another EV that's quicker than every car Tony owns. So that doesn't really narrow it down all that much.
No, it doesn't. when do you reckon we'll find out?
Well, it hasn't got on sale yet, so...
Another clue.
Exactly, so
do some thinking. Okay, let's do some news. All right, Croft, we start with you. The Kia EV6 price and specs were released around about when last week's podcast was released, so we thought we might cover off on this as well. Yeah. Give us the full details.
Well, I've got to tell you... looking at this vehicle, this is, forget about EV or ICE engine comparisons. This is one of the best looking SUVs that I've seen, or crossovers, whatever you want to call it. But it is absolutely stunning, and more of what Kia is doing now. And the fact that they're going head first into EV world with EV6, and then we've got EV GT coming, which is their faster version. Then they've got Sorento coming, and they've got all sorts of stuff. Got a whole range of electrified vehicles on the way. They're really jumping ahead of the curve. And, you know, these are fairly affordable. So if we're talking prices, prices start at $67,990. plus on roads for the entry-level EV6 Air, and that's a rear-wheel drive with a single electric motor on the rear axle. Or you can jump to an all-wheel drive version, which, of course, has a front-mounted motor as well. And that will cost you about $82,990 plus on road. So while it's probably more than people are expecting when you consider a GT, a GT Sportage will cost you in diesel language about 57 drive away or 52.7 plus on roads. This is a bit more, but this is a, you know, Paul's done a walk around. I haven't actually sat in this car, so he might be able to enlighten us what it's like inside. But from the images on carexpert.com.au, it looks pretty fancy inside, much more fancy than, for instance, a GT Sportage. Now, if we're talking ranges, because everyone will want to know the range of this vehicle and the power. So the entry-level model, 168 kilowatts, 350 newton meters. Range, 0 to 100, about 7.3, drops to 5.2 for the all-wheel drive version, so quite a bit quicker, Not a rocket ship like a Tesla, mind you, but nonetheless, quite a bit quicker. It's a 77.4 kilowatt-hour battery. There is a smaller 58 kilowatt-hour battery, and the range is very good, up to 528 Ks on that single motor. A single motor setup, which is pretty good. The GT line rear-wheel drive quotes 504 kilometres, and that's on 20-inch wheel package. And the EV6 GT line all-wheel drive quotes 484 kilometres, because that'll be a slightly heavier vehicle, of course, and will chew through the power a little bit more. Our EV vehicles are for sale in February, so they're here, guys. They're already here. EVs are here. Affordable, fairly affordable EVs are here. I do think $67,000 is, you know, it's expensive for people that are used to buying Kias for 52 being the top spec GT Sportage. So people have got to get used to paying more for their vehicles. But, of course, don't forget they're not paying for petrol either, and they're getting a fill for what people amount to about a – Paul can probably fill me in on this – but relatively a quarter of what it costs to fill up with petrol.
And even less if you're using solar or have some other sort of configuration at home that allows you to leverage green energy.
Yeah. Now, the I think the enthusiast side of EV or take-up people that like to get into EVs early is the GT, EV6 GT version, which will do 3.5 seconds, 0 to 100. That is bloody quick for a family EV. Again, probably not in line with what Tesla Model X can do, but also a lot less expensive. I don't believe we have prices yet for EV6 GT, but expect them to be considerably more, I would suspect, than the top of the range EV6.
Okay.
Yeah. Just on the interior, it looks really nice. It reminds me of the IONIQ 5. The key difference here, though, is especially for the Australian market, the EV6 has a local ride and handling tune. One of the things that I really didn't like about the IONIQ 5, we had the advantage of testing it at Holden's former proving ground, and that really gives us a good variety of roads. The second you leave a smooth surface, it really is sort of all over the place in terms of the ride and handling and the body control. So I'm hoping that given this has had a local ride and handling tune, it will mean that it rides significantly better than the IONIQ 5. My only concern is, I mean, the pricing, I think is the pricing. It's not the end of the world, but it's at the entry level that they probably haven't hit the mark. If you can get a Tesla Model 3 for $59,000, it's just hard to imagine why you would spend extra for the entry level EV6.
Yeah, although this will go up against the Model Y when it arrives, of course, which what is the pricing of the Model Y? Do we have that?
We don't have it yet. I'm just concerned that it's – I don't know that it will go up against the Model Y. The problem is the boot space just really isn't there. I remember when we had the IONIQ 5, I struggled to fit a pram into the boot with other things. It just didn't have the depth and it was quite high. They didn't take advantage of the fact that with an EV you have plenty of storage outside of just your boot space. Like the front storage was absolutely abysmal in that IONIQ 5, something like 27 litres, whereas with the Tesla you actually have a huge amount of storage. Same with in the back of a Tesla. So I think when the Model Y comes, it will be significantly roomier as well inside than this, beyond what the Model 3 is already. So yeah, I don't know. I'll be interested to see how it goes, but I think it looks fantastic. It is such a good-looking car. I saw one in person here around the Australian Open, and they really just look sensational.
They've nailed it from both ends, Mandy and Paul. They've nailed it from the front end, and they've nailed it from that. That rear end, by the way, looks a little bit like someone's been looking or certainly likened the DBX.
It does a little, yeah.
There's a little bit of that going on. I don't know whether that rear light is a continuous LED strip.
It is, yep.
So that's going to look really, really cool. And even on the entry level, the EV6 Air, that should look good. So, look, I think they're going to kill it with this vehicle. I know they're more expensive, but I think they'll already queue up. There's 500 confirmed for the first year, and they'll be staggered in their delivery. And I just think they won't be able to make enough of these.
Well, they already can't.
They've got
like a 2-year wait list. The difference as well between Hyundai and Kia is that these guys are selling the EV6 through dealers only, whereas Hyundai was selling online only. So it'll be interesting to see how that allocation works, because it'll be, I guess, first come, first serve, whoever your dealer wants to give the car to, as opposed to whoever reserves it online first.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I think importantly, the Kia does have an 800-watt architecture in it.
Pulse.
So it evolved architecture, so it can fast charge. So sort of, 15 to 18 minutes for a full charge or an 80% charge, which is good. But again, to highlight the lack of infrastructure in Australia for anyone but Tesla owners, it can be problematic. I think I said recently that I had a Taycan for a few days and had to drive 25 Ks from my home to get to a rapid charger. That was the closest position I could get to, and that's just not acceptable. So I think everyone needs to be doing a lot more on infrastructure in Australia to make these to incite the take up of these great looking vehicles.
Mm.
You know,
absolutely. All right, we're going to move over to the next story now, Paul. We've had another delay on a car, this time the Hyundai Santa Fe Hybrid. Why is this?
Oh, look, I just don't understand how this happens. I get that we have, shortages of semiconductors and all that sort of stuff at the moment, but we're getting roadblocks when it comes to these vehicles coming to Australia, and the latest is that Santa Fe Hybrid. And we were promised that it would be here late 2021, and then we were told it would be early 2022, and now they reckon it's going to be late this year or potentially early the following year. And that presents a big problem, because Kia already has the Sorento plug-in hybrid here. They're bringing the standard closed-circuit hybrid as well. So it means that when the Santa Fe finally does arrive, the market will well and truly be saturated by hybrid SUVs that people can already buy. So it's interesting to see how this goes for them, because by the time it does arrive, I suspect that supply constraints will be gone and we'll be in a better position for people to have cars. But how well will it work for them? I mean, that is the big question mark.
Yeah.
Do you think Santa Fe buyers might start looking at IONIQ 5 instead in terms of a FEV to a, go all the way and buy the EV?
Well, that's the thing. The Santa Fe is just a standard hybrid. It's not even a plug-in hybrid. So I just think they'll go to another brand, especially if Kia is offering the Sorento with a hybrid. I think that will snatch most of the sales. Mm. And the funny thing with the Sorento plug-in hybrid, we all fell off our chairs when we heard the price. It's something like $80,000 drive away. But the thing was that once you actually priced a Kluger on the road, it was the same price, if not more. So I think that Kia will really sort of dominate this segment if Hyundai can't get their sort of everything into gear.
Yeah. All right. We're going to stick with some more EV-themed topics here. Croft, Jaguar is developing an EV platform.
Yes, Mandy. Jaguar is developing a bespoke EV platform, and they bloody well have to, Mandy.
Exactly. Jaguar
has been in the doldrums for so long now. Their SUVs, the F-Pace, is their bestseller. I guess the E-Pace hasn't worked, frankly, and the I-Pace is a great-looking vehicle, and we all loved that vehicle when it first came out, and it's still, even today, basically 3 years on, it's still a great-looking vehicle, but it hasn't sold. Yep. So Jaguar has one option before they literally roll over and die, to be honest, and I think it's going the EV route. And the CEO announced it recently that they would make this go it alone. I think he used the term rather than pair up with another platform from someone else. And so at least he's having a crack at it. And they've called it the Panthea, which is the sort of scientific word for all things sort of cats, if you like, or big cats.
Right.
And so I guess he's been slightly creative in that respect. But
how about creating some cars, Chad?
I think they need, as I was just about to say, they need a lot more. They need to do a lot more than come up with a creative term for their platform. And, you know,
but Tony, that's the thing. They already have the I-Pace,
which is actually a car, right?
Yeah, it's a really good car, and it's efficient. It is, from an EV standpoint, it's a great EV. Yet they just do not sell any of them. And I think perhaps the issue they had was making the I-Pace look really different. If you think about the Porsche Taycan, the Tesla stuff, it all looks fairly like a normal car, whereas the I-Pace went down the route of looking a bit sort of in your face. So I wonder if that's going to change with these, with the Panthea, whatever it's called, platform, whether they'll just go with normal designs.
But Jaguar, they haven't made some great moves in the past. I don't know. It's a real shame, you know, because there are so many Jaguar fans in Australia. Yeah. They've had such iconic cars, from the original E-Type Jag that killed it, the XK140 before it. You know, these are fantastic cars to drive even today. And then they came up with the XJ Saloon, which was by far the best driver's four-door sedan. Yeah. One of the best ever made. They used to destroy the Germans back in the day. The Jaguar was the car to have. And I have to say, Jaguar as a brand in the United States is better regarded than it is here. And I don't know why. It was always above the Germans in the US and pretty much still is. But again, they've not had a good product run. And this is where the Germans have killed them. BMW, Audi and Mercedes-Benz have had an incredible cadence of cars over the last, decade, and they just keep improving and doing it. Whereas Jaguar used to rely on their style and their, their luxury. And to some extent, they've lost all that. And it's a real shame. So let's hope that by going EV only in a bespoke platform, they can create cars that people want to buy, because at the end of the day, they've got the Koreans knocking on the door, they've got the Chinese knocking on the door, and these are EV manufacturers now that are really, really kicking some goals. And, suddenly here we are talking about a Kia for 86 grand, 86 grand on the road. So, things are changing really fast, and people are prepared to pay good money for these EVs, and Jaguar will need to really dig deep and come up with something fantastic because we've got Tesla coming on board with Model Y, and no doubt they'll have other things coming as well. And you've got Mercedes-Benz, BMW and Audi coming with an entire streams of EVs, and you've got new companies coming like Rivian and other brands that are hoping to pull a big wad of sales from the likes of a upstart Jaguar, a new startup for Jaguar. So,
yeah,
I wouldn't want to bet on them. You'd need to see what they're coming up with first, and see how they're going to price these vehicles.
Yep, That'll be the deal breaker, won't it?
Yeah,
the price.
100%.
We're going to go back to the US. Lastly, now, Paul, there's been some recalls for Tesla's rolling stop feature.
Yes, they introduced something, this is so stupid, called assertive mode in the States, and this is on their vehicles with full self-driving beta. Just a bit of background, the full self-driving beta is only available to customers who have bought the full self-driving package, which is like $11,000 Australian, and then you need to sign up for the beta program, which they've only given to a select number of people. And this assertive mode basically makes the car drive more like the Americans that Tony mentioned earlier, which is less regard for the speed limit, more tailgating, and in this instance, not stopping at stop signs. So it basically instructs the car, if there is no other pedestrian or car traffic, to slow down to 10 k's an hour at a stop sign before coming to a complete stop, and basically just going through the stop sign now with this thing switched on. So it is
not
truly,
sure how that'll go here, Paul.
No.
Well, yeah, I mean, it is truly bizarre, and it's strange to me that they didn't think this would get a slap on the wrist at some point. I think as a side note as well, look, I love our Tesla. The tech and all that sort of stuff is great, but I constantly see videos that people share of the full self-driving beta and how bad it is. And it really concerns me that if this is the future of autonomous cars, I do not want any part in it, because they are just nowhere near ready. And it is really one of my good friends is an engineer, and he made a good point the other day on Twitter that this should be a job for engineers to do, someone that is trained and able to stop the car if it does something stupid like driving into oncoming traffic. They have e-stop buttons. They have data loggers. They have all of these features in development cars when they are testing these features to stop them from injuring or hurting just random members of the public who have not signed up to be part of this testing process. So I just think it's remarkable that this is still allowed to go ahead. And I hope that if they do roll this out in Australia, that the government actually comes in and stops this from happening.
Yeah. How long or how far away do you think Tesla's self-driving technology will be almost faultless? I know it's sort of hard to put a year on that, but yeah.
You kind of can't, because I think looking at how it is now, you have so many random factors. If you're on a freeway where everyone's in their own lanes and the lines are perfect, it's a little more obvious that there's a way for it to work. But if you're in and around the city where kids can run out in between cars, you've got drivers who all of a sudden come into your lane to go around a car parking. There's just so many factors that these guys just cannot consider as part of the programming.
I think you've hit the nail on the head right there. I think you could actually have full self driving in traffic. And then the moment you sped up to, say, 45, 50 Ks, then you are back to hands on the wheel. I don't know why you couldn't do that, and you could actually, you know, get away with full self driving in peak hour traffic, which might be a 40-minute drive, by the way.
Well, here's just one example where even the highway stuff is a little bit tricky. On the news the other night, there was dash cam footage of a guy driving in a ute, and a toolbox fell off another ute. And it was a big stainless steel toolbox. It was just offset the center of the lane. And another guy in a ute swerved to avoid it, hit it, and basically rolled. Now, in an instance where you're in an autonomous car, I mean, how does it know where to swerve? How does it know that it's able to swerve anywhere? You know what I mean? You're relying on this thing to do driving. And until we're in a position where every car is autonomous on a particular stretch of road.
And talking to each other, by the way.
And talking to each other, and you confidently know what that car's going to do. You just don't know what a human is going to do. They will always make a decision for themselves, and often the decision will be the opposite of what you think they're actually going to do.
Yeah. Okay. More news can be found at carexpert.com.au. G'day, James Wong.
G'day. Men.
You spoke very, very briefly last week in our intro about your time, your first time behind the wheel of an Aston Martin, and it was the SUV, the DBX. So we thought we might get you back on to talk a little bit more about this in depth. But for anyone who didn't listen to last week's podcast, can you just sort of tell us how much that car meant to you?
It's not necessarily that specific car. It's more just the brand itself. Like I've grown up loving cars and car racing games and motorsports for as long as I can remember. Probably about 2 or 3 years old is when I started jumping on. We used to have a Sega Saturn. I started playing Daytona USA on that, and I was probably 2 or 3. So it's a long time. And one of my first experiences with Aston Martin was playing Gran Turismo 3 on the PlayStation. I think I won the original Vanquish in a championship, and I just instantly fell in love with the brand and the design. And I seem to have an affinity for British brands, but like especially the high end stuff that they do. I don't know what it is. Like it's not really a James Bond thing, even though my name sort of rhymes with it. I don't know what it is. It's just the design, the fact that Aston Martin has such history in the automotive world, the way that they've really stuck to a set formula for a really long time. Whether it's the design, whether it's the drivetrains, they just exude class and desirability. And I'm also somebody that when I think about if I was fortunate enough to drop the kind of money that most exotic sports cars require, that it would be like an Aston Martin or a Bentley that would best suit me because I'd be the person that drives it to work every day. So James, there's something about them.
What are your thoughts about the bit where they stopped doing their own engines and they just started using Mercedes engines and Mercedes infotainment and Mercedes infotainment?
That bit saddened me slightly a few years ago, but then it also was, I feel like the Mercedes infotainment is an improvement on the tired old Volvo systems that they were using under Ford ownership. And if you manage to get your hands on a DBS at the moment, you can still get an Aston Martin engine. It may be turbocharged, but it's still done by them. But that was, speaking of like the personality and character that even though it's got like a Mercedes engine, and I can maybe elaborate on this later, but I was actually surprised with how much work had gone into making the V8 not sound like an AMG, because I actually did the AMG GLE launch last year. So the 63, which basically is the same engine or the same motor at its core, and it definitely does feel different. I didn't get in it and I was like, oh yeah, this is just a Benz masquerading as Aston Martin. There has been work gone into, and they say this every time they have some sort of press conference or event, that they really do a lot of work to the exhaust and recalibrating the engine and the transmission and whatever to make it feel like a proper Aston Martin, because there are certain traits, whether it's the ease of use in day-to-day driving, or that there's a certain sound that they go for that gives it that distinct character that the brand is known for. And you know, even though V12s have been their headline act for a long time, V8s are a big part of the Aston Martin DNA. There's a lot of, you know, V8 Vantage is one of their most iconic models, and there's a lot of vehicles in the company's history with really good sounding V8s. So I know that it's very important for them to still maintain that. It'll be even more interesting once they move into like the full electric space in the next decade or so, and you know, trying to figure out a way to keep that signature experience alive. Because you know, us as motoring enthusiasts, and you know, having Tony on the call of all people who, you know, travels the world, and I'm using my hands a lot here, but you know, travels the world and drives the most exotic super sports cars on racetracks, like he would know full well how important it is to have a good sound as part of the driving experience in these kind of cars. So once we lose that and move into this next generation of motoring, it's going to be really interesting to see how brands like Aston Martin sort of navigate that space.
Jaywo, the Aston Martin Signet was not a success. No. When they tried to branch off into another, segment other than their sports cars and GT cars. So
who would have thought?
A bit of an ugly duckling, wouldn't you say?
I did have the honour of test driving that little thing, and I did actually like it. But anyway, the DBX, how does it compare to something like the new Bentley Bentayga, which I find quite stunning? We saw one in the States recently, and we were all kind of blown away by how good it looked. And I would say that's probably the closest competitor to the DBX.
Absolutely. And it's really good that you asked that question, Crawf, because I did a Bentley Bentayga drive last year as well. So nice. I was in a really good position, I guess, having recently come out of that car and sort of understanding the difference between them. Because, you know, these boutique brands, even though they might be competitors in a pricing way or, you know, on paper way, that they obviously have a lot of history. And, you know, when it comes to design or the way they engineer their powertrains and whatever, they have very distinct personalities regardless. And I think the thing about the Bentayga, and I remember saying this on the podcast maybe 6 months ago, was that, you know, as great as the Bentayga was, it looks cool, the interior is lovely, it's decked out in every surface you can look at is covered in leather, and, you know, everything feels really well built, and it's, you feel like you're in something special. At the end of the day, the Bentayga was still an Audi underneath all the different shades of cowhide. And I guess the difference, the one thing that really stuck out to me when I drove the Aston is that it didn't feel like anything or look like anything else that I had ever driven, regardless of some of the Mercedes bits scattered around the cabin. You know, it's own car. And it's very, a lot of the componentry, even though it's got a Mercedes infotainment system, for example, it's common to all of the Aston Martin models. That screen, the way they've set it up, you know, the button, gear shift selectors on the console, which is a very typical Aston Martin thing. It feels really special, and it actually feels like really, really expensive and like handmade. It feels like a tailored, you know, couture-like product. And I think that's maybe something different to what I experienced with the Bentayga, because even though you can, you know, customize it to your heart's content and do so many things with it, even the dashboard design, the steering wheel's lifted out of a Q7 or a Q8, the digital dials and the infotainment system is all Audi stuff. And while Audi makes really good tech and really good components that I would actually argue are better than the Mercedes-Benz parts used in the Aston, I still think overall the Aston just felt like a completely different vehicle. And I think that especially if you're a keen driver, I think that the Aston is more of a driver's car than the Bentayga. The Bentayga is the kind of car that it's better off, you know, loping about in the city, and, you know, and occasionally you give it a blast on the freeway. But I think the Aston really shrunk around me when I took it out towards Yarra Glen out east, and you go through some nice winding roads up, not mountains, but, like, you know, it's a bit hilly and whatever out there. And I was actually quite amazed, because this car's like 5 meters long and 2 meters wide. Like, it's absolutely massive. And the way that it was able to handle with such confidence, limited body roll and everything, it really felt like a sports car that it maybe, you know, you're sitting up a little bit higher, but it didn't feel like you're leaning about and whatever. It definitely shrunk around you, and it gives you that impression that it's a much smaller car than it actually is.
Yeah, don't forget, Bentley do have other editions of Bentayga a la the Speed, which I once took on track in the UK. So they do get into those high-performance variants and they sort of skew sports rather than luxury in those things. So, like I said, I think it'll be a major competitor. Do you think the buyer is a very similar buyer that would cross-shop both of those cars, or do you think they're inherently Aston fans or Bentley fans?
That's a really good question. I think when I asked the Aston people when I picked up the car about the demographic, they couldn't really give me a clear answer. I think there's a few different kinds of buyers especially in Australia, because we're such a diverse society. The kind of people that will buy a DBX, there's a couple of different categories. There are the kind of people that want just a really nice car and they want one now. And I feel like that's one type of buyer who might be cross-shopping between Aston and Bentley because they're walking down Swan Street in Richmond or the equivalent in Sydney, and they've got, you know, a certain amount of cash to spend. They want to, you know, they want an SUV and they want a boutique or high-end brand. And they're sort of like, okay, what can you get for similar money? This is the one this is the demo in stock in the showroom now. I'll go look at that and I'll look at the other one. There's that kind of buyer. And then I think there's the other kind of buyer, or the other main kind of buyer, is the kind of person that is an Aston fan who perhaps has a DB11 or might have a DB9 or a Vantage or something, and they might want something for a partner or, you know, someone that they know that doesn't really want to have a sports car, but they need or they have a sports car already and they want to cart around the family or whatever. And it's sort of like the same sort of buyer that you get with each brand. I feel like Bentayga and Urus and all that kind of thing were developed for existing buyers that needed a more practical vehicle or wanted something a little bit different. And I think it's the same thing for Aston Martin, but there's a couple of different buyer types that you've got in that mix.
Do you think James Bond will ever drive a DBX, James?
I don't know. I don't know, especially now that I don't want to spoil the most recent movie, but things might have to change for the next 007 movie. I know that one of them was driving a DBS Superleggera, but who knows, if they have to start going off-roading and things like that and catching baddies in the desert, maybe they'll have to use a DBX. You don't know. Especially that new one that they developed the other day. It looks bloody quick. There aren't many things that could outrun it, so you never know.
What's the most Aston feature in that car that screams Aston to you?
I think it's really like the overall design, for me anyway, because I haven't driven a V12. I've ridden shotgun in a V12 with Paul. He took me in a DB11 once. But even though it's an SUV, like you look at it and it's instantly recognizable. The front looks very much like a DB11. The back looks a lot like a Vantage. The interior, you know, it's very Aston in the way that it's got Aston bits everywhere. Like the seats and everything look like they've come straight out of a DBS. The way that everything's crafted, it's wonderful. The key, there's a glass element in the key. The key is almost like 2 kilos. It's bloody heavy and it looks gorgeous. And, you know, everything just feels like you would feel in another Aston Martin model. And I think that's really what it is. And it's also the way its personality on the road. It's a big, comfy, powerful vehicle that, you know, you can drive to work, you can have a bit of fun in, you can drive interstate with, and you'll be in supreme comfort. And unlike the Rapide, which this car sort of replaces, you can actually fit people in the back. Yeah. The Rapide had a very common complaint that the back seats were next to unusable for people of, you know, average adult size. So Croft would fit, but Paul and I would not. And
trust me. It was I once did a trip from Sydney to Brisbane in the Rapide with our boys, and 1 hour behind in the original Rapide was literally you required medical attention after you got out.
Well, thankfully, the DBX doesn't have that problem. It's got a massive back seat. I can fit behind my own driving position, and I'm a little over 6'1", so, you know, sort of slightly above average at these days. And the boot's huge as well. It's got like 500 and something litres of space in there, so you can fit the dog or, you know, a weekend's worth of luggage or a pram or whatever the buyer's going to need it for. It's got more than enough space for that. So it combines those typical Aston traits that I think people would really want from the brand with the practicality and versatility of a high-riding vehicle format. And that's to, you know, maybe use Rolls-Royce terminology because they hate the word SUV, but I guess that all these brands are finding fancy and creative ways to redefine the term SUV, I guess, because, you know, you look at this thing and it's sort of SUV, but it's very swoopy and coupe-ish, and, you know, the proportions, it sits very wide and low, but you obviously step up into it. It's a real mix of things, and but it's also still quite a departure from the original concept. I'm sure you all remember there was the DBX concept was literally like a DB9 or DB11 that had been raised by 30 mil and that's it. Like, yep. That's literally all they did. And then they put like a shooting brake body. I think that's the thing. It's not like a raised shooting brake. That's probably the best way to describe this. And I think you look at it and everyone knows it's an Aston.
Is there any room for improvement? Was there anything that you were like, could have done a bit better?
Yeah, I look, the Mercedes tech is not my favorite, and some of the Mercedes components. The infotainment system is the old command system, even though they've reskinned it. So it actually looks better than some of the old Mercedes stuff, but it doesn't function that same way. Like, I think they could have maybe done a little bit better there and, you know, implemented MBUX and made it AMUX or whatever. And, like, they've put a couple of stalks in. Like, I hate the Mercedes stalks. I don't know whose idea that was. They could have coated it in leather or something to make it look a little bit different, but the stalks don't feel very nice, and there is some switch gear that's lifted straight out of an old Mercedes, and I think the key term there is that it's the old Ben stuff, so that easily could be something that they improve. Other than that, I guess, you know, it on paper the performance isn't that competitive with some rivals. The standard DBX, even with 405 kilowatts and 700 newton meters, claims a 4.5 second 0 to 100 sprint, which to some people will be like, well, that's not as fast as a insert car here, right? And I don't even think it has launch control. So it's not that, you know, not that the target buyer is probably ever going to use a feature like that or require a sub 4 second 0-100 sprint, but I guess it's just something that they can boast about, which the new DBX 707 is going to change. But then, you know, that again, that DBX 707 is running an upgraded version of this V8. I would have loved to see them, you know, have a V12 option.
Yeah, interestingly, it matches the acceleration performance of the Bentayga V8, which is obviously not by accident. But you're right, it's not overly quick compared to something like a Urus, which isn't that much more expensive, to be honest.
No. The other thing that I might add is that even though the exhaust sounds cool, and this particular car had a sports exhaust upgrade, I don't have all the individual options pricing, but I understand the car, even though its base price is $357,000 plus on-road costs, it was optioned up to about $420,000 or $430,000 before on-road. So you're looking, this is essentially a $500,000 car once you have it registered and in your garage. So it's an expensive car. That the exhaust sound was cool, but to have it do all the things that it should be doing, you had to have it in Sport Plus, which turns off like stability control, or loosens the traction control a little bit, whatever. So the sportiest mode that you would normally use on a racetrack or something like that. It would have been nice if you could have more of that, you know, the burbles and the pops and the cracks in like, you know, in a normal mode, or you can adjust a little bit more. So that would have been nice. And that's actually a bit of a Mercedes thing. That's something that I have take issue with some AMG products, that to make it sound really, really good, you have to have it in the most aggressive setting. It's just small things like that. At the end of the day, I am probably not the kind of person that's going to give proper constructive feedback that would be appropriate for a buyer, because for me, I'm a very pragmatic person. And I think I said this with the Bentley review, where, you know, I might it's cool to have all these options and whatever, but I would be like, oh, well, I can, you know, get a vehicle for half that price with similar features and whatever. But at the end of the day, the kind of buyer that buys a car like this is like, well, I've got this base car that's already very well equipped. It's got, you know, great design history. It's like buying a designer handbag, right? You don't buy it with your head, you buy it with your heart, and you just make it yours. And I think that's one thing that we're starting to see less of further down in the industry. Like if you get into some of the premium brands, they're starting to remove some of these options, and you really have to spend a lot of money to go bespoke, which then puts you in a price point that, you know, isn't too far away from something like this. So the fact that they still offer that whole experience with just a different type of vehicle is really cool. You know, maybe it could be a little bit faster, maybe it could be a little bit louder, maybe they could put in a screen that doesn't feel like an old E-Class. You know, other than that, I just think it's just super cool, and it's hard to criticize it or really knock it when, you know, it's one of those products that I don't know how much my criticisms will matter to somebody that's going to buy something like this anyway. So
yeah.
Joe, I always remember the DBX that I drove as being slightly harder riding than I would have liked it to be, even in comfort mode.
As that Jeep, Tony?
The Jeep was actually fabulous over potholes of LA. Far better than that F-150 Platinum that, rode like, as the term goes, truck.
Novice Tony, I think is his name.
No, Tony does make a good point. The comfort mode is probably a touch on the firmer side, and when it's an air sprung model, it would be nice to have like a mode that gives you that like magic carpet feel.
You think so, right?
I'm
pretty sure the Bentley does that very well.
Yeah, the Bentley does it well on 22-inch wheels, as I experienced, and I imagine something like a Rolls-Royce Cullinan would just take it to another level. So, you know, that potentially is another area for improvement. But then at the same time, an Aston Martin buyer might want something that's a little bit sportier feeling even in its most comfortable setting. So, you know, it's sort of like a comment, it's a bit of feedback. Whether it's an absolute criticism, I'm not sure, but, you know, it's one of those things, yeah.
Yeah. All right, you can look forward to that review on the site very soon. Thank you, James Wong.
Thanks, guys, for having me.
That's an end for this week's podcast. Just a little bit of a continuation from the intro about the US trip that you guys had. Crawford, you managed to get your eyes on the new Corvette.
Yeah.
What did it look like?
You know what? I I'm a bit disappointed, I got to tell you. Everyone's raving about it, and our colleagues in the States. And do you know what? It looks big and heavy. It looks like a really big car that could have, you know, had some weight saving engineering got into it rather than, I don't know. They say everyone's saying it's a great thing to drive, but I think it's too big.
Tony, I don't mean to throw shade on our US companions, yeah. But this was kind of like when Holden and Ford were in Australia. Yeah, Australian media all love them. I wonder if it's a case that the Corvette is really only sold in the States and it's about to come to our market. I wonder whether we will review it differently when we get a chance to drive it.
Mandy, the whole thing was that, and we probably got spoiled because one of our colleagues owns a Ford GT 2018 model. It's worth about $850,000 US at the moment. He paid about $460,000. This is one of the best looking cars you will ever see. In fact, I think it's the best looking supercar on the planet right now. Even now, 3 or 4 years later after it's launched. So when you put that up against something like a Corvette, and I know there's a massive price difference, but I think General Motors could have done something else. And I think they're always wanting to emulate Ferrari. That was General Motors' big thing. Was to come up with an American version of a Ferrari. And that's what Corvette was always supposed to be. And I've been a fan of generation of Corvette. Back when I was at school there in the 80s, I loved every chance I got to go in a Corvette, or better still, drive it, I would jump at, and I always raved about them. But things have moved on. And if you want to compete with the Euros, Ferrari, Lamborghini, and now, of course, Maserati with the MC20, and even Ford, the Ford GT, and you've got to come up with something really special. However, I don't think that will diminish our comments, diminish Australia's love of that vehicle, and I think they'll sell every one they can get. It is a mid-engined supercar, and it's very, very quick out of the box. I don't know what the pricing is. Is it 200 grand or...?
Yeah, I think once you've done your on-roads, it's about 200 grand. And keep in mind that is the cheap one. So they're doing the Z06 or the Z06, and that will come with the carbon wheels from the Aussie engineering company, Carbon Revolution. So I think that they will go up in price, and we'll see at least 200 sticker plus on-roads for the Z06 when it finally arrives here.
But then again, guys, to be kind to General Motors and Corvette, the cheapest 911 Porsche 911 you can buy starts at about $245,000-$255,000 for a Carrera, then goes to about $275,000 for a Carrera S, and this has arguably more performance than those vehicles. So, and it is a mid-engine vehicle versus a rear-engine vehicle. So there are a lot of pluses. I just think it could there's a lot of creases on it. There's a lot going on with that shape. But I'll be very, very interested to hear everyone's comment when we start seeing them on the road here.
And once you get behind the wheel too, it'll be interesting to see 100%. How it drives. So, yeah. All right, lastly, Paul, can you let us know what cars we've got coming up next week and launches?
Yeah, so we're through a slew of French products that are under embargo until March. So these are plug-in hybrids, so we'll be excited to talk about those a little bit later on. We'll be getting behind the wheel of the new BMW iX as well. I've seen a few of those driving around dealer vehicles, and that I've sort of been looking forward to driving along with the BRZ. Scott Colley has the very unfortunate task of going to Portugal to drive the Cayman GT4 RS.
I did want that, Paul.
Yes.
Wow.
So I'm sure that will be a struggle for him to do that. So I'll be keen to see what he thinks about that vehicle. So, look, it is back in action at the moment. I mean, COVID saw a huge, huge slowdown for us in terms of launch events and vehicles through the garage, but I'm just having a look at the calendar now, and my eyes are like into the back of my head at the moment, twirling around. So, there are an exciting few weeks coming ahead for us.
Oh, that's so good. It's starting to get back on the road again. Awesome stuff. Paul Marrick and Tony Crawford, thank you very much.
Thanks, Mandy, as always.
Thanks, Mandy. Cheers.